serving veterans from sea to shining sea. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes on the 75th anniversary of a day that brought relief and hope. Victory in Europe was announced May 8, 1945. Phil Benson had landed on France's shores on June 6, 1944 with the 6th Engineers Special Brigade. May 8, 1945 brought much more pleasant memories.
Rumors start spreading, the war is over. And I said, where in the world did that come from? And as soon as we got on the street, there were just thousands of French women with loaves of bread, La Guerre Finie. And that was...
The war is over.
Yeah. And that was an emotional thing for me.
Did any of those French women plant a kiss on you?
Not me. We were marching down the street. I wouldn't have refused one.
Sure. Did you think the war was over for you, or did you wonder, I might still have something to do?
Oh, I thought it was over, but I didn't think that I'd be going home the next day. They took us and sent us to where the Germans still had submarine pens, and they never gave up, and they were still there. So we formed the perimeter around the Germans, and we were facing out to keep the French from going back in. So we did that for a week or whatever, and then we left, and they sent us to Germany. I was glad that it ended. I can't get over it. I can't tell you the joy I heard when they said the war was over. I can't describe it.
And they even said it in French.
Oh, yeah, La Guerre Finie.
Some of the celebrating servicemen had been fighting for years, others just a matter of weeks. But the news of victory was just as welcome. Sam Terasaki was a 20-year-old mortarman with the 100th Infantry Battalion, also known as the Purple Heart Battalion. It had been attached to the 442nd Regimental Combat Team.
You know, as an infantryman or mortarman, you don't get the latest news. In fact, some of the old-timers knew that the war was going to end then. We never knew that.
When did you figure it out, and what did it mean to you?
Didn't believe it. We were in a town northern Italy after we had captured a number of Germans and had them on the run. I was in a town, spent a miserable night in this town square, rained all night, covered myself with my shelter half, and woke up in the morning and all kinds of native Italians running around said the war is over. I didn't believe them, but it was shortly after that an observation plane flew over and dumped the bundles of the Stars and Stripes and said the war is over. That's when I knew.
How big of a relief was that?
Oh, you don't. I remember none of the guys jumped up and down or anything. It just kind of took it as a matter of fact. We were happy that it was over, and it was a day or two later we had a memorial service at an abandoned warehouse. Our chaplain delivered a sermon and read the names of all the guys in the 100th from the first one that was killed down in Salerno. Very sad. Couldn't help from crying.
I believe it. And I'm sure, even though, as you're telling it, there was only about a month that you spent in real intense combat, that had to be the longest month of your life, right?
Yeah, I think so.
And sure, there had to be days in there where you thought your name could have been one of those that chaplain's reading.
Well, maybe wondered why I'd survived and the others didn't.
Did you have days where you thought that was going to be it? Did you?
Oh, sure, yeah. Pray to God when we're under artillery fire that the next one wouldn't come over and hit us.
It's got to be a pretty helpless feeling.
It is. What do you do? Put your hands over your head and hug the ground as much as you can and hope that you don't get hit. I know I recited the Lord's Prayer all the time.
I'm just imagining being in those shoes and how lonely and scary and just difficult that must have been.
It was. It was scary. When your legs start shaking, you can't stop it from shaking. That's when I knew I was scared.
And you mentioned that memorial service while you're still there in Italy, and the war has just ended, and they're reading off name after Japanese surname. Some of those guys are probably guys you knew?
Yeah.
And you told them, you're crying.
Yeah.
How should we, today, remember those guys whose names you heard read that day?
Well, I don't know. I just live a good life, pay them back by living a good life and being tolerant.
The next veteran we're going to hear from is Jim Gerhart of the 736th Medium Tank Battalion. Before we hear why his location on May 8, 1945 was so meaningful, we need to hear what he went through 10 weeks earlier on February 25th.
We hit a couple of anti-personnel mines, which just shake you up a little is all. It's a little startling, but it doesn't hurt anything. Tank commander stopped the tank to assist somebody else, and about that time we took a round, a German round, 88, through the engine compartment. As I found out later from a retriever, the round came through the engine compartment, right down the dead center of the two engines, the two Cadillac engines, took off all the spark plugs, went through the firewall into the turret, and then exploded inside the turret where we were sitting. You don't remember anything about an explosion. You get a big red flash, your ears start ringing. You don't really feel any pain. You don't really know what happened either. And I know when I came to, I knew that I'd been hit, of course, but the explosion ripped open my jacket zipper. I didn't get blinded right then, but my eyes burned, of course. My ears were still ringing. In one hand, I had a glove on for handling hot shells. And one gland was bare, and when the shell went off, it was only 2 feet away or so. So my left side got pretty well tore apart, and the tank commander, he was on the other side of the turret. His right side got all tore up because he was on the opposite side. The gunner who was in front of it was only about a foot from the explosion. He was killed. The driver right in front of him was also killed. The turret raised in the air and came back down and trapped the assistant driver inside the tank, so he was stuck there, and there was no way to get him out, and so he burned it as in the tank. I finally got out through the turret, because I left my turret open, because I considered that 5/8 inch of armor on the tank is not going to stop anything coming through anyway. And so I went out to the top, and I discovered two men, engineers, on the back of our tank. And so I pulled them off the tank and took them with me out into a 105 hole out in the middle of the field to wait for medics. And while we're out there, they kept throwing mortar shells and a few rounds of 88s out in the field. And a couple of them, two mortar shells landed alongside of us, and both of them duds. But then one of the bombs went off, and it blew another hole not too far from us. And some of the fragments came down and burned us from that. That was about 8 o'clock, 9 o'clock in the morning, and we were out there till almost 5 that afternoon before the medics, well, I can't say the medics because it wasn't the medics that came after us. Our own people came after us. We didn't have any medics come out after us. And they took us back to the aid station. Of course, by this time, I know I got a leg busted up and bad, and I had a tournament on it, and I doctored up the other two guys with sulfur drugs to keep them from getting infected or poisoned. And they evacuated them too, and they took me back to an aid station. And they gave me a nice shot of morphine, which I made me feel pretty good. Then they put me on a jeep. Oh, when they was picking me up, they put me on a board. They didn't have a stretcher. They put me on a board. And when they did, they twisted my leg, and which was quite painful. And if there was any new cuss words invented, I invented them that day. And they probably could have heard me as far as Berlin, because I was really upset. And they got me back to the aid station. They fixed me up there a little bit. They put me on a jeep. They also put blankets around me because I was freezing. And it was cold. It was in February morning. It was February 25th, yeah. And it was still freezing weather. And so when I got on this jeep, they put one blanket over me, and it took about a mile before that blanket was gone. So by the time I got to the hospital in Liège, Belgium, I was almost frozen again. And then they put me on a stretcher to take me up to the room where they put you in line to be the next operated on. They had a buzz bomb come over, which was a German, kind of a jet air, gasoline jet engine thing, and it exploded. It landed and exploded in the courtyard of the hospital. And the German prisoners, they dropped me, and so I skidded all the way down the stairs, bounced from step to step down a whole flight of stairs. And they finally got me upstairs, and they put me in the hallway. By this time, of course, I'm blind. I can't see anything, can't hear much either. So I heard somebody ask me if I wanted a cigarette, and of course I said sure. I didn't know if I could smoke or not. Since most of my face, my left side of my face was burned, and my hands were burned, a few other things. And they had already cut my helmet off because they had it was burned in my head. So they had to cut it off already. Then somebody asked me a cigarette, and later I found out it was the movie star Van Johnson that had offered me the cigarette. Then I remember going into the operating room, and they had us all in cots there, and they took my temperature. And when they took my temperature, the thermometer was so cold that I actually broke it. My teeth were chattering. And they asked me, told me it was my time for me to go. And I said, well, take this guy next to me. He's a hell of a lot better off, worse off than I am. And so they took him, and everything went all right. They fixed me up. They wrapped me up from, primarily from head to toe with bandages. So when I was in them, took me to the ward. And, of course, the only problem I had there was the only thing I had open was my mouth had a bandage across my whole face, of course. And I had enough room for a spoon to get through. And I had a French nurse that every time she asked me something, which I didn't know what she was saying, she'd stick something in my mouth to eat. And if I tried to tell her no, I'd get something else stuck in my mouth. And that was the only bad part about it. And then about a week later, I had this somebody, a doctor I assumed, asked me about my eyes. I said, well, I feel all right. Well, I didn't use particularly nice language about this doctor down there who's going to see about my eye, this colonel. He says, well, we'll see about what we can do. So the next day, they took me down, unbandaged my eyes, and I could see enough to see light and figures. And it turned out the guy I cussed out was the colonel to start with. So anyway, I got away with it. Then we got on the plane. They just happened to put me next to the door, and I was in the top bunk. I didn't have my blankets. They had taken my blankets away from me. I didn't have blankets over my feet. My one foot, my right foot, was almost blue from cold by the time I got to England. And I got off of the plane in England. They put us in an ambulance. Now, an English ambulance is about, three decks high, three bunks high. And you ride in it like you're in a ship going through a storm because it rocks back and forth. And you're sure it's going to fall over. Anyhow, we finally get to the hospital. We go in the hospital, and then the only thing I really appreciated there was white sheets, and they gave me a quart of milk. And it was first white sheets and quart of milk I've had in almost a year.
I'm struck, and I know that you lived this, and I'm sure there have been many nights you thought about it. You've told the story a few times. But to hear you describe it so matter-of-factly, I can't help but think of how horrifying all of this is. I mean, you're hit to begin with this 88 shell right through your tank. You're incapacitated just about. You find your way out of the tank. You're hit again by mortar fire. You're more concerned about these other guys with you. You're helping take care of them. You end up blind for a few weeks. It's going to take you more than 9 months to recover and get back to health. In those kind of moments, for instance, from 9 in the morning till 5 o'clock, waiting in a hole in the ground that one of the American artillery had made, hoping that someone's going to come rescue you, what do you do for that time? What's going through your mind, and how did you believe that you were actually going to make it through all of this?
Well, I knew I was going to make it. I had no doubts about that. I knew I was bad enough that I might wind up with a leg being off, but that really didn't concern me too much. I was still alive. I was still one piece.
The enemy was still firing your way.
First they got to hit me. So far they haven't hit me.
So it didn't bother you. And it didn't bother you when the buzz bomb hit the hospital and the German prisoners dropped you down a flight of stairs when you're already in all kinds of pain?
A little more pain didn't matter anymore at that time.
Now, whenever I interview a veteran who served in the European theater, I like to ask him about May 8th, 1945, VE Day, the day that part of the war came to an end. Of course, your war ended on February 25th of 45, really. But I think May 8th has some special significance to you, too. Why is that?
That's my day I came back to the United States. I got off of General Huddleston, the hospital ship, in Charleston, South Carolina, on May the 8th at 9 o'clock in the morning, and there was nobody on the dock but the medical personnel and a few Red Cross workers, the buses or whatever it was going to take us to the hospital. They had no celebration or anything else, and we had just been told as we was getting off the ship that the war was over. And that's how where I was on May the 8th. It was right there on the ship, getting off.
What a day to come back to a country you weren't sure you'd ever see again. If we were to share all the VE Day memories we've heard on Hometown Heroes over the years, we might be here until the 76th anniversary. I'm reminded of my own grandfather's VE Day story. He remembered a sign outside a church in Germany, which he translated to say, "The air raid shelter is in the sun." Takes a moment for that one to sink in. And perhaps no one appreciated the significance of VE Day more than newly liberated prisoners of war. Camp Lucky Strike was a hastily constructed tent city in Le Havre, France, where so many ex-POWs arrived. Fighter pilot Ray Maloney had been flown into Lucky Strike from Stalag 7A in Moosburg, Germany, on May 7th. He spent VE Day, like so many other starving ex-POWs, trying to put some meat back on his bones. I think the best way to end today's journey back in time is to hear about the opportunity that victory in Europe created for Ray and so many more who had learned what it was like to live in the absence of freedom.
Priority for going home was wounded first, and then POWs, and then guys that had done their tours. And Eisenhower came through the camp, and I didn't sit at the table with them. They had these long tables, and they were feeding us five times a day, small meals, but five times a day. And they were trying to put some meat on us because we all looked like skeletons, you know. And that's what the delay was being caused. The medics were saying, keep them here, let's fatten them up before they,
sure,
they go home. And but Eisenhower came through and stopped and had lunch with us, and he was, you know, talking to everybody, and we were saying, "General, can we go home? Eisenhower said, "Well, we're trying to get you home in style. We don't want you to have a rough crossing." But he said, you know, an option we're considering, but we haven't done anything, was to double load you, you know, half sleep and half stay on deck, and then in reverse.
You get twice as many people since the bunks
aren't on. Twice as many on the ships, yeah.
Yeah.
And we said, we don't care, General. Take us home. And so we came home that way, double loaded. They started to move out, I think, the very next day after Eisenhower, you know, gave the word. Another one of my most emotional moments of my military career was we came into New York City, and we were, you know, as I said, the wounded came first, and then the POW. So we were very early in returning, and of course the country was still celebrating, you know, the fact that we had won. And as we're coming up the straits, you know, Staten Island and Brooklyn on one side, you know, the New York Harbor. On the Brooklyn side, there was a kind of grassy bank, and they had a sign in plants, you know, all very cleverly done. And here I go, I'm going to say, the sign said, "Welcome home, well done." I'm sorry.
What message could have meant more to you in that moment than that?
It was heaven.
Ray Maloney, the 10th and final veteran's voice you're hearing from today. Hopefully this hour has helped us all understand a little more fully just how significant the news of victory was 75 years ago. There's much more with each one of those 10 veterans online at hometownheroesradio.com. And let me close with a request, an assignment, if you will. If you have any surviving World War II veterans in your life, call them up this weekend. Ask them what VE Day meant to them. Maybe they'll turn instead to VJ Day, or maybe it'll open up another decades-old story you've never heard before. Thanks so much for listening today. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you again that freedom is not free.